Well, we finished the story in 1 Samuel about the rise and fall of Saul. Some people see it as a tragic story, and I would agree. He had a lot of potential, and it all came crashing down at the end of the story. So this one we're going to pick up, find out what was it like for David's early years as king, and then his reign. It's not a tragic story, but it's pretty grim in spots, some of the family troubles that David had. So let's look for, again, we're going to look through 2 Samuel. We're going to skip some things, but I want you to look especially for reasons why David would be given so much space in the Old Testament. It seems like the authors were really intrigued with him to devote so much space to this person. But I think you'll have some good reasons by the time we finish here. When David takes over after Saul's death, I wanted you to notice something in chapter 1. I wanted you to see his lament for Saul and Jonathan, which is in the first chapter. It says, "Your glory, O Israel, lies slain on your heights. How the mighty have fallen. Tell it not in Gath. Proclaim it not in the streets of Ashkelon, lest the daughters of the Philistines be glad, lest the daughters of the uncircumcised rejoice." So those were two towns of the Philistines. So he's saying, don't let them know. And it continues. It's a powerful lament. And I'll let you read it sometime on your own. In fact, we'll come back to it when we talk about poetry. So keep that in mind, that poem, because we're going to see another poem later on that, well, another reaction of David. So this is the reaction of David when he finds out about Saul and Jonathan's death. Now, in chapter 2, David is anointed king over Judah. I want you to notice that. Chapter 2, verse 4, the men of Judah came to Hebron, and they anointed David king over the house of Judah. He's not yet accepted by the entire 12 tribes. Did you notice that? It's only the southern tribe of Judah. Of course, that's a powerful tribe, but they are going to back David. But Saul has his own supporters, and they're not going to immediately go over to David. They're going to put forth their own leader, and this man named Abner comes along, and he's going to run the army of Saul to try to not let David take over completely. And so we get this civil war, basically, a split in the country. This is foreshadowing a future split that's going to happen as well. So I want you to see that a southern tribe has gone one direction, a northern tribe has gone some other way. But sure enough, David succeeds and wins in this battle. And one reason that he wins is that David has a most brutal commander who is kind of his, what would you call him, his attack dog. His name is Joab. And Joab looks out for David, but he looks out for himself as well. And when Abner, who was the commander for the other side in the Civil War, when he goes over to David and surrenders, Joab kills him. That isn't what David wanted, but it's what Joab wanted. And David, instead of reacting with real horror, this is chapter 3, verse 28, he says, "I and my kingdom are forever innocent concerning the blood of Abner. May his blood fall upon the head of Joab." But he doesn't do anything about it. Do you see that? He complains. He says, oh, this is awful. But he doesn't get rid of Joab. Joab is going to be his go-to guy. Every time he needs something done that's evil and dirty, Joab will go get it done, and then David can wash his hands of it. So some things don't change. We still have that going on, I think, in politics today. Maybe not to the extent of the actual killing and all, but there are certain people that are go-to people, aren't they, that carry out some dirty work for somebody who can remain above the fray. So David is has taken over for chapter 5. David becomes king over Israel. So he now takes over the entire area. And then another thing that happens important in chapter 5, the second section of the chapter, my Bible titles it, David Conquers Jerusalem. Did you notice? Remember what we said before, the children of Israel had come in and only conquered certain kind of a checkerboard sort of thing, bits and pieces of the land, but not the whole thing. And up until now, there was a group called the Jebusites. who lived in that area. But Jerusalem was a perfect choice for David. He really wanted that because, first of all, it was easy to fortify it, easy to protect it. It had great valleys on several sides of it, so it was hard to attack. And probably most importantly, it was he wanted this place to be his capital because it sat north of Judah. And so it was more central to all of the tribes. And if you know anything about the story of Washington, D.C., something like that occurred in our country. The northern states didn't really want Virginia or someplace south to get the capital of the United States. So as kind of a compromise, they decided, how about right here, kind of in between. So it was Washington, D.C., on a swampy area, not particularly a great choice. But so here's something like that going on. It's a political choice for David. And he sets up his capital in Jerusalem. The ark is brought there. Things are set up pretty powerful for David. Next thing I wanted to look at was chapter 7. Mine is titled God's Promise to David. And I'm not going to read the whole thing. It's a long promise here. It's a covenant. Remember we talked about those? They're contracts. And I want to pick up in, verse 11 of chapter 7. The Lord declares to you that the Lord himself will establish a house for you. When your days are over and you rest with your fathers, I will raise up your offspring to succeed you, who will come from your own body, and I will establish his kingdom. He is the one who will build a house for my name. Now that's what Solomon will do, won't he? He's eventually going to set up the temple and all. And I will establish the throne of his kingdom. How long? What's that next word? Forever. So this is a covenant that's an everlasting covenant. And it doesn't really say if you screw up, you'll lose this. So David is, of course, overjoyed, an everlasting kingdom for him. So this is going to be important later on when in the New Testament people talk about Jesus and they say Hosanna to him, son of David, right? You hear what they're claiming, that he's part of this inheritance as well. So that's going to be the Christian view of things. Okay, so let's pick up then. We've got David as now the king. He goes out as a young man. He's strong, he's powerful. And what I am so impressed with, in chapter 9, David asks a question at the beginning, is there anyone still left of the house of Saul to whom I can show kindness for Jonathan's sake? Now, some of us might say, is this a trick question? Because David has just survived a civil war, fought against the people who fought in the name of Saul. Now, doesn't that strike you? It certainly strikes me that if there is somebody from Saul's family still left, that person represents a huge threat to David. Whoever's left could represent a rallying cry, a rallying point for anybody who was unhappy with David. You know how it is with kings in old days. When they took over, they looked around, found out if there's anybody left from the other side, and got rid of them. You don't want to have that kind of threat hanging over your head. But David finds out that there is a son of Jonathan. Remember, he and Jonathan are such good friends. He finds out this son is still alive. His name is Mephibosheth. I'm glad they don't name kids that anymore, but David takes really good care of him. Chapter 9, verse 7 of 2 Samuel, I will surely show you kindness for the sake of your father Jonathan. And in verse 13, Mephibosheth lived in Jerusalem. He always ate at the king's table. So David doesn't just say, okay, I'll let you live. He brings him into his family, basically, and lets him be part of his family, right, in eating with him at the king's table. So that's an amazing story of kindness, and that he's still continuing to his dear departed friend Jonathan. Well, David's done so well, hasn't he? He's winning battles. He's got his new capital. He's got the entire country on his side. The influence of Israel is spreading. And then chapter 11 comes along. This is the famous episode with Bathsheba. She's the wife of somebody named Uriah. I want you to keep that name in mind. And David is smitten with Bathsheba. He sees her bathing. Gets her pregnant. Oh, things are really tough now. So what's a man going to do? Oh, he's not going to fess up to it. he thinks, well, no problem. Uriah's in the army. He's just come back from fighting. Have Uriah go and spend some time with Bathsheba. And then if the baby comes along, we'll say it was Uriah's. But Uriah is such an upright guy, such a sweet guy. And David says, well, why don't you go on down and, you know, spend some time with your wife. And Uriah says, so sweet, he says, the ark and Israel and Judah are staying in tents, and my master Joab and my lord's men are camped in the open fields. How could I go to my house to eat and drink and lie with my wife? I would not do such a thing. So he's so caught up in his duty to his king, to his commander, to his fellow soldiers. And he says, no, no, I couldn't go home and relax and enjoy myself and do anything like that. So David is sweating bullets at this point. And then this is probably the most despicable thing that he does. It's just beyond despicable. In the morning, I'm in chapter 11, verse 14, David writes a letter to Joab. Well, here we are again, right? Joab's your go-to guy. And he sends a letter with Uriah. So Uriah is carrying this letter, unknown to him. It's sealed, obviously. And here's what David writes in the letter. Put Uriah in the front line where the fighting is fiercest. Then withdraw from him so he will be struck down and die. Is there anything more terrible than that? Let him fight for his country and then pull the army back. Well, those of you who have ever served your country know that when you're in the army or the navy or whatever it is, it's that comradeship, it's that close connection to the people around you that keeps you going. And so here's David saying, pull the army back. Nobody's got Uriah's back. And so Uriah dies. That's exactly what they do. And they come back and they report about this to David. A messenger does. And then here's this awful deed that he just did. And then listen to the words of David. It's so chilling. It's so cruel and cold. They come back and they say, your servant Uriah is dead. Chapter 11, verse 25, David tells the messenger, say this to Joab, don't let this upset you. The sword devours one as well as another. Isn't that a great comment? Basically, he says, well, things happen. Well, there are variations of that saying, but you know what I'm saying here. Don't get upset. Hey, you win some, you lose some. Easy come, easy go. But this is a manufactured murder, isn't it? It's cruel beyond belief. And David, of course, does get caught in it. That's what chapter 12 is about. And punishment comes. And the punishment is, your family is going to be nothing but misery from here on out. And it's so true. All of a sudden, it becomes like a soap opera. You got brothers clashing with brothers. We get terrible things going on, eventually to the point that one of the brothers, one of the sons, his name is Absalom, actually sets up a rebellion against David. And David is forced to flee. And this is chapter 15. David has the army, and he's actually trying to take over. And David has to run for it. And he does, and he's weeping as he goes. Just terrible. And as he's leaving the valley and leaving the whole area of Jerusalem, it says, and this is going to come in a little bit later, this is chapter 16. As King David approaches this one city, there's a man named Shimei, who's from Saul's clan. Okay, so here's that clan business again. Clan more important than the entire king or the entire nation. So this man's name is Shimei. And he comes and he starts cursing David. He pelts David and these officials with stones and ridiculing them. And he calls David a scoundrel. And of course, David still has some fighters with him, some warriors. And one of them says, let me cut this guy down. And David says, well, he says, leave him alone. Let him curse. The Lord's told him to do this. So David is really despondent. Unfortunately for Absalom, he takes some bad advice and doesn't chase David immediately. If he had followed up his coming into Jerusalem by attacking what David had, David was reeling, but he doesn't. And you can read why. There was a little bit of deception going on there. And eventually, he does come after David, but David has rallied enough troops. There's a huge battle that takes place. Absalom is in the battle, and David says, don't let anything happen to my son Absalom. Please, keep him alive. be gentle, he says. So the army goes out. There's this big battle. David's men triumph. A lot of men dead. Absalom, in the old story, you probably have heard it, he got caught. He had this beautiful long hair he was proud of. His hair got caught up in a tree. And Joab comes up. Remember who Joab is. Remember what Joab's attitude is. He wants to protect David. He'll do anything to keep himself and David in power. Well, he knows if he lets Absalom live and treats him well, this is crazy. Absalom is a cancer in the family. And so he recognizes that far better than David does. So he takes three javelins that he has and kills David. And goes back to David and has to tell him what's going on. And then, remember when we heard that wonderful lament, the beautiful poem that David composed and said on the death of Saul and Jonathan? Well, listen to the difference between that and what happens when David hears about the death of his son, Absalom. This is verse 33. The king was shaken. He went up to the room over the gateway and wept. As he went, he said, "Oh, my son Absalom, my son Absalom, if only I had died instead of you. Oh, Absalom, my son, my son." Now, I'm a father of sons as well, and I feel like this really hurts me just to hear him have to say this. Do you hear a huge difference between this lament and the one for Saul and Jonathan? That one was beautiful. It was composed. It was calm. It was carefully constructed. And then you hear this. This is nearly incoherent, isn't it? It's not really poetry. It's not laid out in a pretty set of lines. It doesn't have poetic devices of any kind. This is just from the heart. This is just agony of David speaking here. Joab snaps him out of it in chapter 19. He says, "Hey, get your act together here, right? Your men saved your life." And so David understands that and becomes king again. So he's in charge again. David is in charge again. He fights more. He succeeds. He's nearing the end of his life, and the last thing that he does is important, is chapter 24. He builds an altar, and where he builds that altar is Mount Moriah. And Mount Moriah, if you take it back further, is where Abraham was supposed to sacrifice Isaac. And so David buys the land, and he's ready to build the altar. It'll be the future site of the temple. So he bought the threshing floor there, and he built an altar, but it wasn't the temple. David had too much blood on his hands. And so God says, "You're not going to build this temple to me. That's going to be your son." So we end 2 Samuel. David's still king. He's getting older. He's purchased the area where we're going to eventually see this beautiful temple erected. Now, I ask you to think about why David would be given so much ink, so much space. What are the influences of him? Why is he chosen? And I would suggest he's king, he's warrior, he's religious leader, he's a city establisher. He's going to be in line for this messianic promise. It's going to come from David and from his following family members. So there are a lot of reasons, but David is quite a character. I hope you have a chance to go back and read all the parts, unfortunately, that I had to leave out because of time constraints. So that's the end of our sixth discussion, looking at the story of David in 1 and now 2 Samuel. Next time we'll pick up with what's really a brief moment of glory and then a crashing down of the entire kingdom of Israel. Here they are under David and his son Solomon. It's going to reach its height of power in the Middle East. And then some terrible things are going to come as a result. And it's going to come crashing down in 1 and 2 Kings. So we'll stop at that point.